Well, this is Current Yield, Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air. I'm Jim Grant. With me, as always, is the great deputy editor of Grant's, Evan Lorenz. Hey, Evan.
Good afternoon, Jim.
And Henry French is our sound engineer. And with us today as our guest is Dean Curnutt, founder and CEO of Macro Risk Advisors, from whom we will hear a lot just in a moment. Hey, Evan, I guess two things. First of all, with respect to the demand by Bill Pulte of the Federal Home Finance Agency that Congress investigate Jay Powell for cause having to do with the $2.5 billion thoroughly stinking renovation of the Eccles building. What do you think about it? Is that bullish or bearish for bonds?
Maybe first one and then the other.
Yeah, Dean's going to have something to say, I think, about it. Bill Pulte was the guy, I think, in the very current issue of Grants, we quoted as saying that he was demanding an investigation of Powell in anticipation of his congressional testimony. So that's like divination, right? He didn't even have to hear it or see it or read it. He just knew it was going to...
Yeah, it's kind of the evolution of monetary policy. 40 years ago, when Volcker was raising rates into the mid-teens levels, home builders would mail 2x4s to the Fed saying that we can't build houses with these, you know, you might as well take them from us. And now the regulator for the mortgage industry is calling for the head of the Fed.
Yeah, because of the water features, skylights, roof terrace, he wants them removed for cause.
And private elevator, I think.
Private elevator, yeah. I think that pushed it over the top. Well, Dean, welcome to Current Yield. Dean has been around the street a little bit before he became the entrepreneur that he is today, and he has, before that, a most distinguished career at the University of Chicago, Quanti, Mathy, and copped the prize from Citibank as the most risk-knowing graduate school in the University of Chicago. We have laughed about this a little bit together over the years. Citi is...
favorite bank.
There are many good things to say about Citicorp, but its single-minded devotion to risk control is probably not the top excellence of the institution.
You know, it's when I got that award, it was all the money in the world, $5,000 in 1995. You know, little did I know that they would not just be a recipient of TARP money years later, but be backstopped, I think, twice, ring-fenced assets and so forth. So still happy to have won the reward.
Yes.
But as you said, risk control may not be their finest discipline.
Well, they have good customer service here on Broadway. So, Dean, here you are in the risk business. You are to borrow from someone else around sitting around this table, you are a yes-but guy in a gee-whiz world. How do you eat three times a day?
Well, you know, I try to eat actually twice a day. I kind of skip breakfast these days. Maybe that's consistent with being a yes-but guy. I think we share that as a kind of a common philosophy, which is a certain skepticism about the things that we see. And for me, I think just having been a close watcher of markets for, you know, well more than three decades, it does seem to me that we overindulge, I think, in certain things in markets. You were mentioning the Fed. You know, the Fed has... evolved quite a bit from the Greenspan days, not just in terms of its demands for opulent decor in its premises, but also in this philosophy of trying to tell markets what's coming next. Mm-hmm. And I always just stepped back and looked at that evolution from the Greenspan purposeful obfuscation, I think he called it, to Powell's desire to map everything in front of you via press conferences, which, you know, was an offshoot of Yellen's dot plot, telling you what they thought and where they were going, with the idea very specifically that there would be no surprises. And I think you undo some of the efficacy of policy by doing that. And, you know, I like to say that if you tell me there's not going to be any surprises, I've got a series of trades that I can design that benefit from exactly that. And I think by its very goal of trying not to upend markets, in some ways, the philosophical bent for the Fed of trying to be as transparent as possible almost creates just that, because it engenders a certain consumption of trading strategies We can call them carry-oriented strategies. We could call them short volatility strategies. But they are conditioned to lean into the idea that this entity that controls so much is going to tell you the end of the movie before the movie ends. And you almost create the same outcome that you don't, that you want to avoid.
Would people recognize this problem as one of volatility suppression?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. You're trying to truncate the distribution of outcomes. That's what the Fed's goal is. And I think stepping back, right, the Fed's got this dual mandate, which even in itself is an interesting conflict. For so many years, the dual mandate was going the same way. Right, we had extremely low growth, we had low inflation, and so you could just say keep rates extremely low, continue on the non-crisis quantitative easing path, and the dual mandate was satisfied at the same time. And now you've got, I think, considerably more conflict. So that's two things. Those are both, in some ways, traditional economic objectives, inflation and growth. The Fed acts in the marketplace with such a degree of force. And I feel like it just does not acknowledge that. At 2 o'clock when the Fed issues its statement, every 6 weeks, maybe there's a little bit of movement in asset prices. But it's really when he comes on, Jay Powell, at let's call it 2:30 for the press conference, that the action really starts to occur. And so it's just this idea that the marketplace, the folks that are taking risk, they're hinging so much on the actions of the Federal Reserve. So you've got these economic objectives, but financial market outcomes. And I think that's where I am troubled in a lot of ways by just, again, the evolution of the Fed, which seems to be this caretaker of markets.
Yeah, right.
And again, the interaction between the Fed and the markets, I think, is something we have to pay a ton of attention to.
You're a designer of trades. And let me ask you about a seeming distant long shot, which is rates do not go down 50 basis points this year, but rather go up. And they go up because dollar gets away from everyone on the downside because the growth, because everything's so great, because the tariff shock returns, and lo and behold, it does feed into prices. So how would you design a trade for people who are prepared to accept that seeming impossibility?
Well, let me first by just talking a little bit about my own process. And I think how you set that question up leads me to want to just share the way in which folks on the options side tend to think about things. If you survey a Wall Street portfolio strategist and you're asking about expectations of the S&P at the end of the year, those types of returns, maybe it's sector preferences. Those are all base case type of questions. Where do you think, by and large, the index will wind up? And if you're in the derivatives space, you're spending more of your time on the tail outcomes. You're spending your time on asking yourself what is over or underrepresented in terms of the probabilities, right? Those are what option prices are. They're really probabilities. And so I'm thinking back to actually the last time I was on your wonderful podcast, and that was in 2021. So we were post-COVID. The bulk of the crash was certainly behind us, but the policy response was well in place. And when the Fed puts its thumb on the scale and does so forcefully, markets are going to listen. And so you'll obviously recall Jay Powell had said that these rates aren't going anywhere for a long time. And a couple of things happen when the Fed decides that and tells the marketplace that that's going to be the case. One is, of course, the policy rate comes way down. And so Fed funds futures are pinned at, inconceivably low levels, even out 2 years. And the other thing that happens when the Fed basically pegs the interest rate, at least for a long enough period of time, implied volatility also contracts incredibly to a significant level. So the MOVE index, which is the interest rate equivalent of the VIX, got below 40 which is a, you know, sort of a VIX equivalent of 10. Okay, so super, super low. And so what we discussed on the podcast the last time I was on was, look, for all I know, the low growth post-COVID could be here for a long time. And the Fed could absolutely keep these rates really low. You don't want to fade the Fed. But what I can say definitively, looking at the price of optionality at, this was around 2021, is that you can make the bet that things come back a little faster than the market price, the market prices currently imply, or what the narrative currently suggests for an absolute song. That combination of low rates and very low implied volatility meant you could make an incredibly convex bet that rates just go up a little bit. So that's just, I wanted to just give that as the backdrop for your question, which is, I like to try to think about what the options market's saying about its confidence. It's confidence that things are going to happen. And so I think implied in your question is two things. One is the curve. So the curve currently is discounting two eases for this year. You know, do we get those? You know, I mean, I don't know. You know, I think you've got to first get to, I'm sorry, it's three eases out to December. So July unless something considerable happens, it's going to take a bit for them to get started in July. And so that leaves you with effectively three more meetings left, and they've got to really get it going. So I think the idea of fading the cuts that are currently implied of three for the year, that's a decent, you know, I think that's a reasonable thing to try to fade, that the market's a little ahead of itself in terms of the speed of the cuts. Your question is just around going the other way. And of course, because these cuts are already baked into the curve, you have an opportunity to, you know, put on the opposite bet. Now, I think it would take quite a bit. It would take, you know, some real pass-through of the inflation dynamics, which clearly the progress on inflation has stalled. I think core PCE is at 2.6, 2.7. It's been that way for a bit now. I mean, roughly a year, just stalled out. But Jim, I don't know that they really care. You know, I think implicit, without it being explicitly said, is that the Fed's target is really not 2%. They're not trying to push it to 2%, else the conversation would not be around easing. It would be around tightening.
Sure, two-ish.
Two-ish. And, you know, listen, it's hard to say. And I think you've made this point many times. You know, what's so bad about 1.5% inflation, right? What's so bad about your TV costing less? Now, we know Japan-style deflation or GFC-style meltdown deflation is a dangerous thing, but, you know, I'm not necessarily a believer that you've got to, you know, force inflation to that 2%. I think the Fed's sort of precision around it has always been a little unreasonable.
But Dean, well, the Fed's an important actor in the market. It's not the only one. And right now we have sitting in the Oval Office pretty much the avatar of volatility. How is Trump kind of impacting the possible tail outcomes that you're worried about and also the pricing of those outcomes?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. You know, I remember when Trump won in 2016, as that probability of him possibly winning. Of course, no one had that as an outcome, you know, except maybe some conservative pundits. I don't even think he thought he could win. But as suddenly the polls shifted right towards the end there, there was a measurable increase in the VIX. And it was, oh my goodness, this is going to be chaos. And if you'll recall, the night of that election in 2016, futures were down, I want to say 4 or 5%. Folks like Stanley Druckenmiller took a good look at it and say, wait a minute, this guy's going to cut taxes, you know, in a seismic way, especially the corporate tax rate, which is going to pass through. It's a big one-time jump in corporate profitability. And so it rallied back quite a bit. 2017, the lowest realized vol year in both the stock and bond market in 50 odd years. You got to go back to the early 60s to see something that low. So, you know, I think Trump 2.0, maybe some people were suggesting, well, maybe, again, it's a low, yeah, he's brash and he's active on Twitter and so forth, but maybe 2017 is going to be a playbook again. And obviously, when he won in 2024, the VIX came down a lot. You know, rates went up, but they went up in a almost growth-friendly fashion. And then fast forward to April, the shock from the tariff uncertainty was just so much more than the market was anticipating. You know, I study these events, and that period from April 2nd to April 9th is really, in my own scoring, I'll remove the crash of 87, an incredibly important day in market history, but it's so big that it just, nothing can compare to a one day 20% down move. But when I score the short bursts of volatility in markets, it's GFC, COVID, and April 2nd to April 9th. We'll call it the tariff tantrum, as my friend Corey Hofstein has called it, which I like. And so clearly he can still surprise the markets. I do think that someone got his ear. You know, maybe it was Scott Bessent, and I know you guys have talked about, you know, the bond market reverberation of this event. And so, you know, you walk it back a ton. And perhaps now with the S&P resuming its all-time high, Trump can reclaim it's his economy. It was Biden's there for a little bit, right, for about 2 weeks as the market swooned. And so I'm not sure if he is got a lot more disruption coming, at least from a financial markets perspective. And if we look at one big, beautiful bill, I think we just got to conclude that the agency costs of trying to get our arms around this just, you know, incredible risk.
Let me ask you this way, Dean. What is cheap in the options world? What outcomes, seemingly improbable outcomes, are being priced too cheap, in your opinion?
Yeah, so I'll give you two that I have been focused on. One is the market, this is a little bit of vol nerd stuff, but
uh-oh,
that's what I am, so I'm going to give it to you. The market prices the way in which stocks will be correlated on a forward basis as if the level of diversification will be substantially greater than anything we've really experienced before. So what I mean by that is zigging and zagging. NVIDIA up, Apple down, Microsoft sideways, and then some combination thereof. That the, if we look at a very top-heavy S&P 500 index, the correlation of the leaders is extremely low. Now, it got high during that burst of volatility around the tariff period in early April, but it's since come way back down. So the market prices options on the S&P 500 with an embedded level of diversification that I believe is fragile. I think it's too benign. I think it does not discount the inevitable nature of, or the inevitable shock that will be macro in nature. Perhaps it won't come from tariffs next time because maybe that ship has sailed for the most part. But there's any number of things that lead to correlated moves in stock prices, and I mean highly correlated moves, that the price of S&P options fully discards. So that's the first one that I've...
So how do you play that?
Well, I'll tell you what folks are doing in the hedge fund industry to try to capitalize on this low level of correlation. And, you know, as with a lot of trades in options and maybe in markets in general, good trades often sow the seeds of their own demise by attracting a lot of capital, right? You have a trade that's winning for a period of time, and our inherent bias to sort of extrapolate forward, we like something that, to use that same word again, carries well. It's making money today, but the process of that winning trade attracting capital is pushing the entry price against you. It's
portfolio insurance was great at the start of 1987. It wasn't great near October when everyone was doing it.
Right, and so that was a couple things. One is it just got big. Right. Portfolio insurance failed for a couple of reasons, but one of which was its sheer size. And so there is a certain amount of short volatility that is being sold into the marketplace that has reduced the margin for error. So a trade that's been around forever in the options market is just to collect risk premium by selling options. I always say this, you know, we don't expect GEICO to provide our car insurance and not make money. We shouldn't expect Goldman Sachs to sell us insurance and not make money either, right? That there's a risk premium to insurance over time. Otherwise, why would you be in the business of selling it? The advent of some new structures, some of them are ETF structures, some of them are mutual funds, but there's a lot of capital that is effectively selling options into the marketplace. And even a complex like the S&P 500, which is a gigantic liquid options market, it's a beautiful risk transfer vehicle. You know, there's tons of risk going into and out of this thing every day, but there is a one-sidedness to it. The one-sidedness is that a lot of these structures seek to generate income by selling options. And because everyone's doing the same thing, the clearing price of that optionality, the implied vol, is getting pushed down a little bit. So the margin of error for being short volatility, what we call the vol risk premium, some people call it the VRP, it's shrinking over time. And that's a little bit of a danger. You know, if to be short optionality means you're short the disaster, right? You kind of make money most of the time. And then if you lose, i.e. April 4th and 5th kind of thing, you lose big. So you want a big cushion to be short volatility. And what I'm saying is that cushion is declining. So in some ways, those options are cheap. I think that they're cheap from the circumstance I just laid out. And I think they're also cheap to a forward-looking set of uncertainties in a world that's just, it's hard to get your arms around. You know, all of the, whether it's geopolitical risk, the speed with which technology is changing, market structure, especially in equity derivatives, is changing quite a bit. So that would be the first thing I would say, is that the market prices diversification, and it kind of leaves S&P options, I think, at a level that, all things being equal, I feel like are low priced for, you know, what could be an unwelcome shock to the system.
So you'd buy S&P calls?
It really depends. If you are long the market and you've had a great run, you might think about, now some of this is tax considerations are a thing you have to pay attention to, but let's just take those off the table for now. You could be long a security that's gone up a ton in value, and the marketplace is giving you an opportunity to swap out of that long exposure into something like calls. And in a lot of ways, the call really acts like a put. It's an insurance policy. If I got out of my stock and I bought a call and then disaster hit, I only lose my call premium. I could lose a lot of money still, but I'm not exposed to all the downside because I paid a premium to be long. Give you a good example would be Microsoft. The stock's at an all-time high. It's approaching $4 trillion of valuation. And in a rather typical fashion, it's risen in a low volatility context. And because the daily swings of the stock are on the small side, the option prices are low. So here you have a chance in a bellwether stock that everybody's long, obviously, to take some chips off the table into an option for which the marketplace is really not charging you very much for the insurance, for the very reason that you haven't needed the insurance. You know, we call it flood insurance in a drought, right? What's the price? It's low. And so there are a lot of instances like that, not just in the S&P 500, but also in some of the single stocks that comprise it.
And you said there was one other place where vol was cheap before I interrupted you a few times.
Yeah, and I would say gold. Gold has been an incredible focus for us. Boy, there's so much there. First of all, you've got an asset that's up 25% this year. And it's a correlation to quote Dean Wormer from Animal House to the S&P is 0.0 to the S&P. Okay, so that's a very, very special and unusual asset to have it rise by that much and to be entirely uncorrelated to the S&P. And its conditional correlation on down days is on the negative side. So if I just look at the big down days in the S&P, gold holds up especially well. I find that to be an incredibly attractive characteristic. Now, that's not forever, right? We know that if you buy true insurance on the S&P, like a put option, when the S&P goes down, the put option value is going to go up. Obviously, you're eating some what they call time decay, the option premium. But conditional on S&P falling, gold has done incredibly well, especially recently. I started to look at the volatility on gold. And as with other assets, it's just priced off of what the realized vol is. Okay, so the people that set option prices are, you know, math whizzes that live and breathe in models like Black-Scholes. And their willingness to pay for an option is very much a function of the daily swings in the underlying asset. That's how they extract the profits from their hedging activities. So if I pay $2 for an option, I've got to be convinced that the underlying is going to move around enough so that I can get that $2 back. So my hedging activities are going to manufacture some profits. That's what being long vol does. And obviously, I want to make some more on top of that. If the swings aren't big enough, you're just not going to pay up for the option. So the marginal price setter really cares about the swings. I think about it a little differently. So I care about that. But I really also care about what the asset is telling me at a given point in time. And I think the behavior of gold last year and especially this year is giving us an extraordinary window into, I think, the thinking and psychology of investors. And a lot of this is the, sadly, the, you know, kind of unsolvable problem of U.S. debt dynamics. It is the, you know, Paul Krugmans of the world calling Jim Grant a deficit scold, right? Someone who worries about debt dynamics, and I put myself in that category. And I will watch days, you know, especially in that disruptive period in early April when swap spreads are blowing out and the back end of the yield curve is rising in yield even as the front end comes down. That's an awful dynamic. That's a very unstable dynamic. And then look at how gold behaves on that day. And it's kind of all I need to know that this is occupying a place in investors' portfolios. And you know, I've put a number of people into these trades. And so we watch them incredibly closely that this is a, first of all, the asset itself is an option. There's not a lot of assets out there that can suddenly spiral higher. So it has this very rare characteristic of being an asset that can become more volatile as it rises. That's totally different than the S&P. The S&P becomes more volatile as it falls. Gold picks up energy on the way up. And so what you'll see, and this is what makes the options, in my mind, a cheap thing to really entertain, is you can look out 6-9 months and buy very far out of the money calls on gold. Now, you know, these are low probability items to hit, right? I'm not suggesting this is a layup. I'm thinking about it as a convex hedge against very unwelcome set of circumstances. Could be the dollar falling dramatically. Gold and the dollar are minus 45% correlated. So if the dollar's weakening, it's a very, very strong chance that gold is rising. But what you can do is you buy these 6-9 month out of the money calls, very far out of the money. And what you're playing for is not just a rise in the asset, but as the asset rises, that implied volatility that the market assigns to that option can rise a lot too. And that is a huge, it causes a huge burst in the premium. So that's a second, you know, a little bit more of a macro kind of hedge, but the dynamics of the way gold works, which Bitcoin does kind of the same thing, and they're different assets, but they share this characteristic that the implied volatility can rise as the asset rises. That's a very special and interesting characteristic.
I think you termed it spot up, vol up in your notes. You touched on something that I thought was interesting, which is that the debt dynamics and how U.S. treasuries have reacted in sell-offs, which is that the long-term treasuries have actually sold off along with the stock market. They're no longer negatively correlated, where buying bonds was a good way to hedge your stock portfolio. In the U.K., we saw the Liz Truss moment a couple of years ago where when the U.K. government tried to push through a budget that the market didn't like, rates sold off and the pound sold off. I think the dollar's been the weakest this year since 1973. As we're speaking, the House of Representatives is voting on the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. And I think in some of your recent notes, you've actually been worried that the next crisis could originate in the U.S. Treasury market. if that were the case, how would a crisis in kind of the bond market play out, and how would it hit other asset classes?
Right. So, of course, the U.S. is not the U.K., and we have this luxury, and maybe it's a luxury we'll wind up regretting, because anything that's a luxury, you can overindulge in. And I think the exorbitant privilege of the U.S. dollar is something that's proving to be excellent, but it's almost too alluring for us. And in a world where the politics of belt tightening is a thing of the past, I'm remembering, from the 2011, not just the debt ceiling issue for the U.S., but the European sovereign crisis, what came out of that with Greece was this demand for austerity. Folks like the IMF and the BIS were all into austerity, and how much that's shifted. The idea that that didn't work, that wasn't a good idea. Well, I'm not here to judge whether it was a good idea or not. I'm just saying that there's another side to it, which has also got risks. And so while we have a lot more rope than the UK, and so to sort of see a 2022 event coming, probably not. However, you have to be on guard for these things. You have to realize that, as we pass this bill, I just think it's all you need to see with regard to how serious any of these folks are with respect to tackling this. And, you know, the bond market, the U.S. bond market is one of the great assets of the United States. And I don't feel like it's being treated that way. These auctions have got to clear. They will clear. But we are putting a lot on the ultimate buyers of these with respect to not just the politics of inflation. I don't even think it's inflation. I think it's some part of its governance. The United States is proving difficult to, govern. If you look at the downgrades from Fitch and I believe it was Moody's, both of them point to governance, not just debt stacks, but the ability to get our arms around it. And so, I was not trying to be a fearmonger around the idea that we could have a bond market crisis. I don't think about that as the U.S. is going to default or any kind of thing like that. Of course, the MMTers would say the U.S. can't default. That doesn't matter. What matters is if you got some asymmetric jump in yields, I think we're already very close from an interest cost standpoint to making this very problematic. And so if you got something higher, especially on the back end, you're just compounding your problems very quickly.
Well, Dean, I don't think you're a fearmonger.
Just trying to call it as I see it.
Now you're in good company here at Grant's. And it is a pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Yeah. So on behalf of Current Yield, we do thank Dean Curnutt, who is the founder and CEO of Macro Risk Advisors. And at one point in your career, you were a rising star in the hedge fund world. And I think we can all agree that, Dean, that you have risen. Yeah. So thank you, Evan. Thank you, Henry. And ladies and gentlemen, we have something in store for you next week. There's Evan, have you heard about the Jim and Evan show next Wednesday?
Yeah, I've been hearing really good things about it.
Yeah, it's our debut. We're here to take your questions and to talk to Rick Sandler of Eminence Capital. And we're giving it a try, right? I don't think we've ever appeared together in the video context, have we?
I don't think so, no.
No, it's a full evening makeup, I think, is the call.
I have an appointment with the hair salon to get a perm.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you, and I hope talk to you soon. Jim Grant on behalf of Current Yield.